this is Beyond the Barracks, a podcast about the many and varied journeys of Australia's ex-service men, women and their families, brought to you by RSL Victoria.
In each episode, we'll interview a guest, sometimes two, about their life in service and life after service, exploring the many highlights and challenges that they may have faced along the way.
Beyond the Barracks is a podcast for veterans and their families to tell their stories. Sometimes we may discuss experiences and issues that some listeners may find distressing. Please check the show notes for support services.
We acknowledge that this podcast is being recorded on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri Woi Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation and pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging. RSL Victoria and the Beyond the Barracks team recognises the service of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, just as we recognise the service of all Australians. We are proud of the contribution they have made and continue to make to the Australian Defence Force.
So today we're joined by Francine Dudfield, who served as a medic in the Army, and she's a single mum to twin boys, and she's got a fascinating story to share with us, both about her Army journey and also on her personal life.
Yeah, I'm really excited to hear her stories from the Invictus Games. Gold medal for Australia at the Invictus Games for powerlifting. So as you can see, I'm a big powerlifter. I also tell by the size of me, of course. But I think it's great to hear more women's voices. We don't hear enough as far as I'm concerned, and I think it's a bit of a first for her, so it's exciting. I'm really looking forward to it.
I think so, and I think it'll be interesting to have her insight into life in service as a female and her journey out into civilian life and what that's looked like.
Yeah, and she's becoming a psychologist or training to become a clinical psychologist, so that's something that that's near to all of our hearts. Yeah.
So, Francine, I guess what we'd love to start with is your service history. How did that all come about for you? I know you were deployed overseas on a couple of occasions. We'd love to hear more.
Yeah, so when I was in high school, I was very sporty and I loved an adventure, and I always wanted to join the police or the military. And so when I got out of school, I went to uni, and I just wasn't finding it challenging at the time, and I wasn't really interested. And so I applied to join the Army, and then a few months later, yeah, I got the offer. And so, yeah, I was off, left Melbourne, in 2004, and then joined as a medic.
And I think also, from my understanding, you were a very sporty person. You had a passion for sport. Yeah. What was it about service that enabled you to continue your passion with sport and serve your country? How did they go hand in hand?
Well, I think that's what one of the selling points of the defence is, like they offer a lot of opportunities for sport. Like even in your normal unit, like you'd have Friday sporties, or so they'd really kind of, kind of encourage people to play sport, and it's a way to connect with your colleagues. And so I really liked that part of it. And also there was so many defence teams, so soccer, hockey.
So how did you then progress, I mean, with your medic career in the Army? What kind of jobs were you on? What were some of the highlights? I mean, you were in some precarious situations, I'm sure, at times.
I think, to be quite honest with you, I've actually forgotten a lot of my service history, but I don't know if that's a good thing. But I think some of the things I really enjoyed doing were like military competitions. One of the highlights actually of my career was being able to train with the New South Wales Ambulance Service and complete my SCAP course with them, so Special Casualty Access Team course. And so that was, you know, learning to access casualties, you know, like vertical rescue, ocean rescue, confined spaces, caving, canyoning. So they were, yeah, just some amazing skills to have. And the plan was to then bring that back to Special Operations Command that I was posted to at the time. But, so I really enjoyed that, and I really like that type of work. And sometimes I look back and think, oh, I really should have stayed in Sydney and, you know, did that. But anyway, what can you do? In terms of like my medic work, I think I loved working in any environment that I could make a difference. And Yeah, I think I just enjoy being able to help people when they need it. And we did, I went away on the Canimbla for an operation when there was a coup in Fiji a long time ago now, 2006, and worked in the Navy ship, the hospital there. So, and unfortunately we had a couple of catastrophic events. So we had the Black Hawk crash.
Mm.
And then prior to that we also had a personnel kind of have a fall who had to be evac'd. And so, yeah, just some of that work, like, yeah, just feeling that purpose and seeing the whole team come together and be able to, help people, like save lives and make them feel comfortable in their time of need. And, yeah, it's such a privilege, like being
a healthcare worker. Yeah, as tragic as that, as the Canimbla was, there must have been a great sense of purpose and doing your job. Because, I mean, that's serious, serious stuff. Mm-hmm. At sea, high stakes.
Yeah.
You got people with, issues that are, what they call, hypoxic, but they've been underwater drowned, and very complex, I imagine, in a medical perspective, from a medical perspective.
But I do remember when the psych team came over just to do a brief intervention following this acute trauma, and I remember them asking me, how you're feeling after this, and and I actually kind of felt a little bit bad, because I responded. I said, I actually feel quite comfortable. Like, it's horrendous what's happened, and I'll never, people died and they were injured. But I said, yeah, I do feel this sense of purpose. Like, I did my job, and I saw people around me doing an amazing job. And so, it was it's hard to say rewarding, but I guess anyone in a healthcare profession, when they can see that they've made a difference, it is a real privilege. And and all the training that you've done and time you've spent, reading and doing, a lot of practical exercises, it finally all came together. Mm. And you could see how it all, works in a real situation, because obviously in the defence, it's just training every day. And
are you ever caught off guard? I mean, with all that training, but at the end of the day, when you're actually confronted by scenes that are unfolding in front of you, how do you process that? I mean, can training really kind of, is that enough?
Oh, yeah, 100%. Because I think, the more you train, you just go into, an automatic mode. You just, it just seems so natural. So rather than kind of be oh, my God, now, what do I do? Yeah, you just go back to the days and the times that you've trained and do your job.
There's sometimes a processing can be an event that you expect an array of events. You expect an array of injuries, illnesses, whatever the trauma may be. But no one can expect a Black Hawk helicopter bouncing off the deck of a ship.
Yeah.
And again, some of the injuries that were... had mates on board, and some of those injuries are just not ones we would normally be prepared for. So I guess it challenges your full suite of skills. And I think rewarding's not a incorrect word to use. I get you want to be respectful to the trauma that's occurred, but maybe small are rewarding. And I think being you're practicing or soon to be practicing as a psychologist soon. That sense of mastery and autonomy, I think that's really fulfilling and really, really purposeful. Yeah.
How have you managed your own mental health through everything? I mean, it sounds like you are an advocate for mental health and seeking help.
Yeah.
How has that been for you and processing everything that you've been involved with?
I think, I've seen a psychologist on and off for several years. When I compare what I've experienced in my personal life to my military kind of service, it's kind of a lot worse in my personal life. So so in terms of that kind of talking to mental health post-service, I just find it very therapeutic to see a psychologist and spend a lot of time exercising, speaking to family and friends, and just kind of really being kind to myself and changing those kind of that that inner voice. So being a lot more kind and accepting. But yeah, it's, I think, mental health, like I said before, like, you know, everyone sits on a continuum, so we just have to be so open to help seeking. And I think there's still a stigma around mental health, which is such a shame, but hopefully it's changing.
I hope so, yeah. I can see a future where everyone's got a psychologist or has a counsellor or a debriefing behaviour or practice at least. And it's certainly over my time, you know, pretty old now, 38, but when I first joined the military, it was a dirty word. In fact, mental health wasn't even a term. It wasn't even a term.
Never fess up to needing mental health support.
And emergency services are the same. Like, hopefully we are kind of evolving and understanding that, that there's nothing to be ashamed about with mental health. It's like physical health.
I think you'll have a massive impact. It's unfortunately a fast growing need in the community for it as well, or ever growing.
So am I right, Francine, that you started being plagued with some lower limb injuries? Yeah. And is that what led to your discharge from service?
No, not really. Like, initially I transitioned to ARES because there was an opportunity that I really wanted and I didn't end up getting. And I was very disappointed. And I think I was just ready to move on and try something else outside the defence. So I stayed in reserves, but I enjoyed nursing and finishing off my paramedicine. But yeah, I think that I did, like I still do have just the pain and sometimes dysfunction from, lower limb kind of injuries. But when I was in the reserves, a doctor actually looked through my medical file and saw a lot of the injuries and she said, oh, you shouldn't be in defence. Like, this is, medical discharge. And I said, and I was very, like, dismissive. I said, oh, don't worry about it. I didn't think it would be followed through. And I was like, you know, I'll be right. But then, she obviously was good at her job and she followed through, sent it off to Canberra. Then I came back saying, oh, yeah, because of this and this, medical discharge from the reserves. And I was very, like, at the time it was heartbreaking because I wasn't ready to leave and I always thought I'd be in the reserves. But because I was also pregnant with twins, I had something a bit more important to focus on. So it didn't really, it's only kind of like in the recent years that I've really kind of gone back and reflected on that medical discharge from reserves.
Because something that often strikes me speaking to men and women who have been in service really, you know, becomes part of your identity when that's cut short. How do you navigate that, finding your new your new path out of that? True. And I suppose in turn as well, your love of sport, was that must have been difficult to play and participate in with the injuries?
Yeah, like I'd still tried to play different sports when I got out, but it just became like there was a point where I'd play on Saturday and then my body was like in so much pain and like for a week, and it took my body like a week to recover, and I thought, oh god, this is so not good for my body. But and so then I've kind of started looking at things that are a bit more gentle on my body. I actually tried pickleball the other day. Highly recommend. It was a lot of fun. But going back to that identity, I think that can be an issue, in defence. And even like elite athletes as well. Yeah, like you've got, so much of who you are is, because you're like, you're a serving member and you have that pride and all your friends are, you work with all your mates, you see them every day, you get to put on a uniform, and then suddenly that's taken away. And a lot of people, they don't get to see their friends every day. They don't have that purpose. They don't have that belonging. They don't have the connection anymore. So it can be a really difficult transition for a lot of people. For me, I think because I had the twins and motherhood, I always wanted to be a mum. So I got to focus on that, and And then I started studying and volunteering. So I kept myself busy, but a lot of people don't have that and don't kind of have access to the support that I had. So that's how I kind of got through that period in my life.
Do you still have – how long has it been since you discharged?
So the medical discharge came through 2013, so 10 years.
After 10 years and you've done some really meaningful, purposeful, you know, study and the kids, et cetera, the residue of your service has had time to kind of settle or resolve, if that's the way – that's a term I like to use. What are the little things that you still catch yourself – yeah, that moves your mind towards your service or the military or the attachment. They're little artifacts in your mind that are still there, you know?
I find I'm very structured and routine. I actually worked as a mental health support worker, and I had to go into a correctional facility, and I actually found it quite relaxing because they're so, every time they eat, they had to stand out and do roll call, and everything was just like exactly on time, and I was like, oh, this is great. I think that routine and structure and knowing where you need to be at what time, that's kind of rolled over into my civilian life. And also the language, I know to pick myself up when I said, to you, say again. And I was like, oh, God. But, yeah, just I think that, yeah, I just – I think the language, yeah.
It does, yeah. I still find myself – I haven't been out that long, but in Perth we kind of have a – we're pretty relaxed, you know.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I'll still say correction, you know. So I'll do a public speaking even and just kind of be giving doing a workshop and, correction. What are you doing? You know?
Yeah.
Sound like a dickhead.
I know. Isn't that so funny?
Yeah, but there are little things, and I feel – I'm so glad you said that routine when you went into the facility. I've done some work in footy clubs, and you'd think you'd be kind of a bit nervous, etc. But there's a familiarity to the routine and structure and the discipline and things. And it can be hard out in the civilian world sometimes with a lack of that and kind of thinking, how hard is it to turn up on time or how hard.
Yeah, and I think a lot of ex-service personnel really struggle with that. And even sometimes when I'm hanging out with people ex-service and they get really, really frustrated, I'm like, just chill out, mate. Mm-hmm. We're not in any hurry. I think it's...
Well, that's why I was late the other day. I'm just trying to train myself out of it, you know. Yeah.
That explains it. Okay, good. And Francine, I know you've recently returned from the Invictus Games. How did you get involved in that and the idea of adaptive sport? How important is that for people, for mental health, for physical fitness, et cetera?
Yeah, I've been telling everyone it was just such an amazing event. It was... Yeah, so well organised, and everyone there was so supportive and kind, and you just felt so accepted and comfortable and safe. I really, really enjoyed myself. And I think what led me to apply was I watched the 2018 games that were held in Sydney, and I remember thinking, God, that looks like so much fun. Like, I want to be part of that. And then I applied, and then I actually forgot about it because then we had COVID. And then so after COVID, I got an email saying, do you want to come for an interview? And then, it went from there. But it was just so much fun because we caught up every month or so for training camps in Sydney and just to kind of find that connection again with other ex and current serving veterans. So that was, really special. And just to have something to train towards. So I trained for powerlifting, rowing and sitting volleyball, but it was a really safe environment because everyone around you, if you said, oh, my body's aching or this hurts, instead of them kind of trying to say, no pain, no gain, or like all that stuff, like I'll keep pushing. Yeah, like they were like, oh, okay, well, stop, go see the physio, take it easy, don't push yourself. It was just very different.
Still competitive. But
still very competitive. Yeah.
How important is winning for you? Was that part of it, or was just to go and have fun?
I probably shouldn't say it was important, but, I did want to have fun, and I also did. I think everyone kind of wants to get a medal, but they say it's not about the medal. I'm glad I got a gold medal in powerlifting, so I was pretty happy with that, and because that's something I was really I found a powerlifting coach is like amazing, and it's like a new skill. Like I learned so much, like, cause I've always gone to the gym, but I there's so many other muscles and things that you have to train that I thought with bench, you just kind of just get on the bench press and just do a couple of bench presses like every couple of days.
But we should have asked you to bring the medal in.
Yeah. I know.
It was just amazing experience. Yeah, highly recommend it to everyone. Very lucky, very privileged. I think there were 21 nations competed. So that was really lovely. And, you know, even there was language barriers, but it didn't matter because, like, sport, you know, like, yeah, it doesn't – yeah, we were just all playing together and everyone was so happy they'd come up and hug you, like, if you did well. And, yeah, it was
very
just
supportive.
And having family and friends there was so amazing too.
What's we're kind of relating the theme of Beyond the Barracks is life after surface or the transition and you know families and trying to bring a more of a broader lens to it. What are the nature of the discussions at Invictus around transition experiences? Is there a lot of conversations around that? The challenges of transition, notwithstanding some of the injuries, of course, but.
Like on a personal level, so you know the other athletes that you meet and you're sharing rooms and going for dinner and it was like a very safe space to talk about our journeys and there was so many like commonalities. It's like, oh, this is what happened to me and this is what I'm struggling with, and it's like, oh, me too. And then you know more and more people were like, yeah, that's right, like I feel like that as well. And so that was really lovely to see that.
Okay.
And just have, I guess, everyone's experience validated.
Yeah,
because it can be very, very difficult for some people, and especially people that are medically discharged as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
You obviously invested so much in the lead up to going to Invictus, training and focusing on getting there. What was it like coming back and having to, I guess, readjust and readapt your life without that kind of as your focus?
Yeah. We were kind of warned out about that. Like, you know, you'll come back and I guess it's like other sporting events, like, you know, you come back and there's a bit of a low because, again, like I guess that sense of belonging, sense of purpose is taken away. But I was very lucky. Like I planned ahead. A friend organised something like a team to go in the Bravery Trek, which is like a virtual event where you have to try to do like a certain amount of kilometres. And so that worked really well for me because as soon as I came back, I was focused on that. So whenever I'd go for a walk and then I'd get back on and say, oh, you know, I did 5K and it's to raise money for veterans.
Mm-hmm.
And then also I applied for a Borneo trek with an organisation that is partnering with Invictus Games, Tribal Tracks they're called. And I got a phone call or an email, I think it was just 2 days ago, saying I've been accepted to do that. So in March there's 14 veterans from several countries that will go and do this 10-day trek in the jungles of Borneo. So that's kind of, again, it's given me something to train towards. And for me, I kind of need a goal. So the plan was if I didn't get this trek, to find another like adaptive sporting club or something that I could do instead of training for the Invictus Games.
How important is it for you personally to keep connected with ex-service personnel?
It is very important because there's a like a common experience and language that we share and an understanding that sometimes you don't really find that elsewhere. And so I've got a really close bunch of female friends that I served with in 1HSB, and so we're constantly talking and we go on a little trip away every year, so it's something to look forward to.
Nice.
I love those girls. Shout out to them.
Yeah. and just as we were saying, Harry and I earlier, just as important as the veteran experience is, it also surely has to encompass the family, whether it's spouses or children. How much of your journey have your sons been part of with your service background? What do they know? Have you enlightened them about anything?
Oh, yeah, well, I think it's probably only been the last few years that they've been kind of really interested, and I've been like keen to share my experience with them. So we'll go into the garage and go through like my packs and old equipment, and they love it. I think it's so cool.
Yeah, ten they'd be going, wow, mum, can I have this?
Yeah, they do. And they ask me all these questions about weapons, and I'm like,
buy them little camo packs for about $2.50 at the surplus.
Well,
and
that's not a bad idea.
Like, that's all my kids wanted.
Because
it was like, it's an excuse to get messy and, you know.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't take it off. They'd run away. You go, I'm going to clean your face before you go to bed. And never. And run sprint off down the hallway.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. That's so cute.
Do you gain a lot of your strength from your kids?
Yeah, I do. And they gave me, a real kind of sense of purpose and unconditional love, you know. Like, I've never felt that or really understood that before. But I think when you have children, you know, you're giving it and receiving it for most people. But, it's been amazing being a mum.
Mm. And you're doing it solo by all accounts.
Single parenting. So I co-parent with their dad, who's current serving military.
Okay.
And that has a lot of challenges.
Mm. Yeah.
So, and that was very difficult because we separated when they were two. And so then I had primary care of two-year-olds, and then also had to go through family court, had to sell my property and search for a new one. There was a lot of stuff that kind of happened in that period of my life, which was probably the hardest period of my life, actually. Mm. It was very, very, very difficult. And thankfully I've never been suicidal, but I do remember very clearly driving home one day with my kids from a play centre, and I got a phone call from the lawyer, and it was just like people were just playing games. And I just, like, I remember I thought to myself, God, like, if there was ever a time that I'd like need to end my life, it'd be now. But I never ever felt, I've never felt that. So I have kind of, I guess, a deep respect for people that are suicidal and have had suicidal ideation and then, pull through and survive that. Mm. I was at the lowest of low at that stage.
Yeah, and I imagine that's challenging on a whole bunch of levels, and one of which is you're trying to reaffirm your own identity after a career in the military. How did the military figure in any of that at all, or was it you just kind of got to get on with what was in front of you?
Well, it was interesting.
Obviously a partner in the military.
Yeah. So, like, at the time, I think, and it really gives me, like, a different perspective, because at the time I was just in survival mode and I didn't really reach out for help. And there's so many amazing ESOs out there. But because I was just in survival mode, I was, like, devastated about what had happened. There'd been violence and quite extreme, like, psychological abuse. And, like, even now I'm still working through that. But I didn't think of reaching out to any of the ESOs, and it was only until things kind of settled a little bit. Like, I'm very, very, very lucky. I've come out, you know, quite well from that experience. But when I purchased my own house and then moved the boys in and started really being able to kind of settle in with the boys and reflect on what the previous kind of year, what had happened in the previous year, then I had a bit more cognitive capacity to reach out for help, and the RSL were there, Legacy. So, it was, they really helped me out.
And just continue on that, you know, being a female in defence, having children, they're additional stresses or, you know, additional challenges. Looking back now, putting your soon-to-be a psychologist hat on, do you reflect on how things you would have done differently, or advice for someone and you talked about engagement with the ESO, you know, do you have thoughts on how you might
affect
some change
for a time there too? I had no home. Like, I had to stay with my sister I had to stay in a hotel, a motel actually, with my boys, and then with my sister, then had to stay with my mum. So it was so, so difficult. But now, obviously, doing the clinical psych course and knowing what I know now, things would be very different. And even my choice of men. But anyway, I've done a lot of work myself with that. But I think it's very hard just kind of say, oh, go ask for help when people are struggling so much, and again, they just don't have that capacity. Mm. Like, they don't understand. And also, like, there's a lot of barriers to help seeking as well. There's like embarrassment, shame, stigma. You don't want to like disappoint your family. Like, that was a big thing for me. Like, I didn't want to upset my mum and dad. Like, I love them like unconditionally, actually. But and so, like, to, you know, I think we need to be aware that there are a lot of people that do need help, but there are barriers.
Mm.
So, like, I'm just hoping anyone out there that are struggling with different types of domestic violence and abuse, that, you know, they can find it in them, you know, just to make, like, send an email or make a quick phone call, because it really is life-changing.
Mm.
What kind of supports, if you want to elaborate, have you received from various ESOs, and how important has that been in your process?
Yeah, so I might get a bit emotional here.
That's all right.
That's
take
okay,
your time.
Okay. Again, right. I
so
need to.
So, yeah.
But yeah, so when I moved into my house, I was struggling financially. I didn't have any support. I couldn't really get a job because the boys were so young. And again, like, because I was a trained paramedic, but I would have had to go and do shift work, and it was just a really difficult time. But I reached out to RSL and just said, and it was very hard, because I used to be a very, very proud person, and I didn't also like asking for help. And I just said, like, I'm really struggling financially. I've just moved into this property. I've got all these rates coming in. And I think, like, I've owned a few properties, but, you know, when you first move in, there's so, like, I had to do renovations. Yeah. I had to, you know, it's all the other bills that come in that I didn't really budget for. And so I asked for, you know, like, there was an itemized list of what I asked for, and they came back, like, above and beyond. They did, like, gave me so much more than I asked for.
That's what they're there for.
Yeah, yep. Yeah. And a lot of those stories aren't, maybe the RSL's better at telling their own story now, especially since Dale's been there. But I think those stories are really powerful and need to be out, because when you are in those challenging times and you don't look up and you can't see and you're a bit embarrassed or whatever, knowing these stories and knowing it's part of the reason we're doing the Beyond the Barracks, so that people can hear and hopefully. But it's a very challenging area.
Mm-hmm.
Is it an area, mental health in veterans in particular, or what you know, in terms of where you want to take your psychological practices?
I think I'd have to be cautious, because I still have a lot of biases towards domestic violence and perpetrators, and also what. Yeah, and there's a few other kind of themes there. But so maybe when I'm a bit more senior in my career.
Yep.
But at the moment, I'm not really, really sure, to be honest.
Yeah, okay. Any area excite you in psychology in particular, or?
I think.
You're doing some pretty hardcore placements. Like, you're going to Alfred next.
Mm. Yeah, the trauma service.
To the trauma service. Yeah, that's like front intense. Line. That's in the trenches.
Yeah. I think.
Big time.
Like, I do think that's probably somewhere that I'll feel quite comfortable and want to work in, like that acute setting and those acute presentations.
I can see that environment. I can see why it's attractive, because it brings. Probably the good things from the military, the great experiences. You know, the Canimbla is really powerful.
Yeah.
You reframe that, and that is something really powerful, that experience. Mm. And then your new role as a psychologist, and then that's kind of makes a lot of sense. Dynamic, isn't it, really? Yeah. Like, uber dynamic.
Yeah. And I think also with the paramedicine and nursing, I've worked in emergency departments before, and so, seeing those kind of injuries. Yeah, again, like, I'm comfortable with that. And, but then, I think maybe emergency services as well. That's something that I'm quite interested in and potentially doing research in. So, yeah, but children, like I'm working with primary school kids at the moment, and that's really enjoyable as well. And then just seeing how that works in with, you know, their parents and their teachers, and you can make a real impact if you start young, that yeah. early intervention. And even parenting and perinatal mental health, actually, that's something, yeah, that I'm quite passionate
about.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
I should have asked this perhaps earlier, but I'm curious also, Francine, to understand the pressure maybe that you feel, or is it a perceived pressure? Maybe it doesn't even exist, I'm not sure, but in a male-dominated environment, serving in the ADF and perhaps even participating in something like the Invictus Games, I would assume probably more men than women, does that add pressure onto you? Do you feel like you need to be a voice for females and represent, and what challenges does that come with?
Well, I hope I am representing females. Like, female veterans are amazing, and I think in any male-dominated industry, it is difficult for females. I feel like that we lose our femininity, and, you know, we feel like we need to be strong and super fit, and that's where you get the validation and respect from. And I know that, like, that I guess that happened with me because I was very competitive and loved my training and loved running and weightlifting, so... I kept up with the boys, but, you know, for women that didn't, they, you know, would be shunned, or so they probably had, you know, a lot more issues than I did while serving, yeah, which is a shame, but yeah, there's a lot of kind of, I guess, challenges that women have in defence that males don't, even like coming down to, you know, sexual assaults, especially like the older generation, that was like a very, very common thing to have occurred, which is, I was actually speaking to a doctor recently, and she said most of her clients who were over a certain age, that most of them had been raped or sexually assaulted. Mm. And that just, yeah, makes me feel sick. And she said it was the culture, like people didn't, she's like, now, like, you know, that it'd be a lot less common, but people would just look the other way or think it was almost a rite of passage. Mm. I'd never heard that before. So
there's still an attitudinal shift, at least, to happen. I know the military as a whole still trying to change. Sometimes I used to look at the army anyway and think it was like a recovering alcoholic, you know, the old 70s mustachioed military.
Oh, yeah.
And some of the, yeah, and I like being a lad, you know, having the beers and carrying on, and but that's it. I know clearly where the boundaries are. But I used to think, wow, that's, you know, that doesn't pass muster. That attitude's just their attitudes.
That's right.
They're the parts of the defence that you wish you can.
Yeah,
you know, change, but it's these institutions. I mean, it's very, very difficult. You know, I don't know if you've heard of a group called the Jørgetroppen. They're the Norwegian Special Operations Women Only Team, right? And
cool.
I did my master's in pathways for women in sport, elite pathways, so cricket Victoria, cricket again,
of course,
and at the same time we were working on the female project, right, it was called, which is, you know, it's rubbish just naming it a project, you know what I mean? And like itemising women. And I discovered these group of women, the Jørgetroppen, and instead of the women coming to a male categorised, you know, criteria you know, X chin-ups, push-ups and all the rest of it, and that had failed in a lot of places in the world, they said, well, bugger it, why don't we make our own criteria and our own set of, you know, standards.
Makes sense.
And we'll get they piloted a few groups, and now they're, you know, they're the kind of go-to example. And these women are not, you know, the average 15 to 20% less. They're benching, push-ups, chin-ups, they're out shooting, they're better decision makers, they team, you know, because in a lot of those emergency services you've got to swarm teams. You might not, you might be working with someone you've never met before.
Yeah.
You know? So it's interesting, but even with the Jørgetroppen have been around for 10 more years now, and we should be sending people there to go, this is how, let's listen to the women. What do they think? How do we, and they're very feminine. They're very, they've maintained everything, you know, so it's a frustrating area and, I hopefully we'll get there.
Yeah, like even down to like equipment and stuff. Like, you know, nothing was like ever fitted a female body.
No, that's right. The
interesting
uniforms. Yeah,
didn't even think about that.
Yeah. So we're a bit backwards, aren't we?
Also humans. Yeah, especially at the moment, they kind of every time you have faith in them, they manage to
do it.
Disappointing, isn't it? Yeah, I know.
But there's a lot of good people who are working really hard to turn their culture around, and I think you know, in a large part, great intent, and but it's a big challenge. The mustachioed old bloke at the bar still a little bit there.
And just to sort of, I guess, wrap up, Francine, what kind of, I don't know, lessons would you like to impart with your boys for their generation moving forward?
So I just want them to be kind and tolerant and understanding and just compassion as well. Like, and all of those, like, for themselves and for others. So, I tell them that quite a lot. I think they're sick and tired of it. But, I think just that self-compassion and compassion for others, it would really go a big way in changing the world we live in at the moment.
Mm.
Mm. And I've got one to come out here to it.
Yeah.
If you had some advice for young women serving out there at the moment, who may be starting their career at the end of their career, a couple of top tips or words of wisdom
I think, like, again, that self-compassion and be assertive, you know, listen to yourself and your body and be your authentic self. Mm. Like, try not to have, like, this culture dictate, you know, how you know, you should behave or think or feel, and just, to be proud of yourself because... Yeah, it's an amazing journey that all the girls have been on, and and you've contributed so much to the nation and the Defence Forces.
You used a word there, just to continue that, being more assertive. When we do women's leadership, you know, there's a lot of groups out, which I really encourage in the corporate world, because that's a tough gig, especially at the executive level. That's a word that comes up a lot in conversation that I hear with women's conversations. What's that mean to you? And have you got like an example of somewhere where you've checked yourself and gone, I need to be, and then you've been more assertive, or an example?
I think that's like being assertive is something that I'm, I guess it's always a journey, and I'm still working on that, being like the assertive skills, because a lot of the times you don't want to, you know, make waves and you don't want to be seen as the one that's, you know, causing an issue, so you just kind of keep quiet. But then, like, it eats you up inside because you're not being authentic. But I think that comes a lot from having a healthy self-esteem and self-confidence. And if you're around, like, a toxic culture and environment, if you don't have, you know, healthy relationships in your life, it's going to be very hard to be assertive, because I think first and foremost, you know, you need to have that self-love and, you know, have a real healthy self-esteem, and I think that's quite difficult. But I think there's a few times in my life that I've kind of wanted to say something, but I haven't. And I think, like, even talking more wildly, like widely, with moral injury, and a lot of people that have, like, even overseas on deployments and like in all aspects of life, not just military, I guess. But when people do keep quiet because they're fearful, you know, I think it takes a lot of courage to assert yourself and speak up when you know something's wrong and something's not right. There's a lot of work, I think, that needs to go into that space.
Yeah, it's a really good point on moral injury, that it seems to be more tangible when you talk about moral injury versus kind of mental health. So not you know, everyone can turn their mind to a time they should have said something and they didn't.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really powerful way to kind of make the example that goes with mental health when you're feeling down or whatever, you know, the same kind of power of speaking up, you know, don't be regretful of that.
Yeah.
But that's a big area for you to dive into in research. Yeah. That's an area in the future for sure.
And that's a term I've never heard of, moral injury. I've not come across that one before.
So, it's you can imagine it's just either witnessing morally contradicting events or having your values and beliefs challenged. You can also, it's vicarious as well. So, you know, for example, you can go into environments like Iraq, it was mentioned earlier, and the collateral damage that you see and witness. So it's we're still kind of understanding moral injury. It's still coming through, but I think the premise behind it is, you know, witnessing potentially unlawful events,
unjust
events, you know, and war by its nature's immoral. Yeah, you could make a very strong case for that. So, I wonder, you know, probably getting a bit out of the lane here, but we could probably do better at preparing men and women in the Defence Force for they will come up hard against their testing their values and beliefs.
Yeah.
A lot of takeaway messages from today, and I think one of the things that really resonated with me from you is kind of a concept of being kind to yourself, listening to yourself. What are your needs from a mental perspective, a physical perspective, backing yourself. Yeah, I think that's a really nice sort of takeaway.
Yeah, that's nice.
Be kind to you.
Yeah.
And I really like the idea of having something to look forward to, you know, us as psychologists, if I can say, that's a really powerful tool for whether it's performance or self-care or having something to look forward to. So I love that. And you're off to Borneo in the next.
Exciting.
Yeah, that's going to be awesome.
Yeah.
Big trek.
Lucky. Yeah, I know. I'll just start training.
Yeah, something else to focus on.
Yeah, that's right.
Next challenge. Yeah. Good on you. Well done. Thank you, Francine. Well, that was such an interesting insight into Francine's world, both in service, her medic career and her transition out, and what that's looked like with her involvement in adaptive sport. And I think my takeaway message, what really resonated as a mum myself, is to just be kind to yourself. I mean, she's going it solo with twin boys. She's set herself a number of challenges. She's been through a number of challenges, but through it all, she's kind to herself. She's taking care of her physical and mental well-being.
Yeah, and I really enjoyed listening to speak about the challenges and not only in her personal life, but being a woman in defence, and I think that was really powerful. You know, a key psychological pillar, if you like, to mental health is having something to look forward to in the future. And that really stood out for me, whether it was her in Invictus Games or she's off to Borneo. Again, I think that's a really powerful takeaway for me, and it should be for all of our listeners. But really enjoyed talking to Francine. A little bit emotional, but that was nice. I thought that was good of her.
Real and raw.
Yeah, absolutely.
If this podcast episode raises any concerns for you, please contact Lifeline on 13 11 14. If you're a current or ex-service member of the ADF or a family member of a veteran or someone who's currently serving, you can access free and confidential 24/7 support from Open Arms Veterans and Families Counselling on 1800 011 046. Current serving members of the ADF and their families can also contact the All Hours Support Line on 1800 628 036 for confidential support. RSL Victoria is here to provide assistance and support to past and present service personnel and their families. Importantly, you don't have to be a member of the RSL to receive assistance from RSL Victoria. You only have to be a current or former member of the Australian Defence Force, our allies, or a dependent of either group. To access RSL support, you can reach out to your closest RSL sub-branch or contact RSL Victoria's Veteran Central Service on 1300 MILVET, 1300 645 838.